We made this.
Hi everyone, and welcome to The Time Is Now, Soylent Green is People. My name is Kurt North, and I am your host today for this week's episode, which is The Hand of Saint Sebastian. And as always, I do have a guest with me, and I've got a particularly special guest with me today. It is, of course, our good friend, Anthony Black. Hello, Tony. How are we doing, mate?
I'm all right. The only person normally who calls me Anthony is my mum. So,
Sorry.
No, it's fine. I'm feeling very much like I'm going back in time to the 90s, in fact. To 1998, when The Hand of Saint Sebastian would have premiered, when I was living at home with my mum, and I was about 16 years old, and she used to wonder, why is he watching this weird show about like, you know, mummified corpses and conspiracy theories. And this one, Kurt, this is one of the most balmy episodes of Millennium I think they've ever done.
It's nuts. That's the one thing I put in my notes was, it's nuts. It's absolute nuts. And I think it's just one of those episodes where you just think at the end of it, what on earth have I just watched? But I love it.
Yeah, exactly.
That's the thing. Yeah. I just absolutely love it. So it was episode 8, wasn't it, of season 2. And it was written by, obviously, our good friends Glenn Morgan and James Wong. I think this must have been about their 9th or so episode, maybe even more than that.
It was their 9th, I think. Yep, spot on.
Yeah, okay. And it was directed by Thomas J. Wright, and I'm sure we'll get into his directing in this. There's a few scenes in here I'm particularly enjoy for this one, actually. I think it's a really good one. It also sees the return of CCH Pounder as Cheryl Andrews as well.
Yeah.
Which is always a good thing. Yeah, so obviously The Hand of Saint Sebastian, I think we need to just get our ratings out of 10. Now, the event, obviously, is that effectively Frank and Peter go on a little trip to Germany. That's basically the story, isn't it? So what would you rate this out of 10 then, Tony? And what's your general thought on it, first off?
Okay, so I have always loved this episode. I would say it's a good solid 8 out of 10. Now, I don't think many people would necessarily agree with that. I get the feeling that this is one of those episodes that when you're, if you're a kid and you watch this, or you're younger, you'll love it for this pure, like, Indiana Jones escapism of this. But I think a lot of people, as they got older, might think, this is, like, really mad, like you said, a bit nuts. Yeah. Very, very different from the usual Millennium formula. Although, admittedly, as you've discussed on many of the Season 2 episodes, we've discussed, I think Darren Mooney and I discussed in The Curse of Frank Black, by this point, Millennium doesn't have a formula anymore.
No.
That's gone out the window. So it's a very, very experimental and brilliant season of television. And this is, I think, even 20 years later, every time I watch this, I think it's great, just simply great fun. Apart from the fact it sets up lots of different things that will then pay off, particularly in Owls and Roosters, which is the big mid-season mythology dump for the Millennium Group, and sort of picks up on things that were set up in episodes like Beware of the Dog and stuff like that beforehand this season. It's just a really, like you say, Frank and Peter go to Germany, have a bit of a mini break, do a bit of investigation at the same time, hunt down an ancient relic from, you know, 1,000 years ago, and then go home.
Well, I was saying I couldn't understand the story. That's basically it, isn't it? Really?
It's a really sort of esoteric grail hunt, basically, for the titular Hand of Saint Sebastian, a relic from 1,000 years ago, which Peter claims has the power to, you know, defeat the evils of the Millennium. It is Frank Black and the and the Last Crusade. It, you know, yeah. And that is just all the way through the clear sort of modus operandi. It is Morgan Wong, I think, off the leash, having fun, tapping into lots of their different inspirations, and I'm sure we'll talk a bit more about it later. So I think it's I always have a great time with this. What about you?
Do you know what? I am exactly the same as you. I had this down as 8 out of 10 because what I was going to say was that it is nuts. It doesn't the evils of the millennium, and what does that even mean?
Well, exactly.
So you've got them running out to Germany. I know we'll get into this as the episode goes on, but you know, it's trying to broaden the canvas with all that element of going to Europe and finding this holy grail. It's something that they pick up on, as you say, in Owls and Roosters with various artifacts that then later come into play in those two episodes. And I've said in the beginning and the end and Beware of the Dog that it's very much a tick list of what we need to get rid of to get rid of the shackles to start off again. And this feels like this is what you're going to see in 6-7 episodes time. It's an adventure. It's espionage. It's a cop drama, as we'll talk about it, especially towards the end, with our good friend Joseph Heim. But yeah, I think it's a wonderfully fantastic gonzo out there episode, and it's just fun. It is just fun. I've watched it 3 times in the space of the last 72 hours, and I never seem to wane from it. Which is I think is absolutely amazing. So yeah, so now that that's out the way, I failed unusually for me. I failed to actually look at the IMDb score for this one. I believe that you do know the score. The tables are turned. So I'm going to have a guess at this. And so knowing how Millennium works, that we've got, I would say around 217 votes. I'm guessing, and I'm going to say on what you said about the fact that it might not be so much there for it, but it may be pulpy enough for people to enjoy. I'm going to go with an 8.2.
Okay, so your guess as to the number of votes is very good, actually. It was 211, so you're only six out there. That's pretty good. You're a little bit too high for the actual score. But right, you're not a million miles away. And it sort of, I would say, tracks firmly towards the midpoint of the season, which right. I'd say is fair enough. 7.8 it comes out with. Now,
right, okay.
The highest rated episode is,
I think it's 8.8.
8.9, I think, for 8.9. Behind Me. Yeah. So it's... And the lowest is like 6.7, which is for a single blade of grass. So it's sort of in the median middle, you know, in that sense. And I think that's fine. I think it is it's pulpy and fun enough to pull people through. But I think it's one of those things that if you analyse it, which is exactly what we're going to do, there are lots of holes. There are lots of moments and things that I think don't hang together. But it doesn't really matter. So I'd say 7.8, fair enough,
yeah.
Really.
Yeah, I mean, you've got to think of the episodes that are actually in this season as well, don't you? I mean, you've got the two Darren Morgan episodes. We've got Doomsday Defence coming up.
Yeah.
We've got Curse of Frank Black. You've got, Somehow Satan Got Behind, obviously, Somehow Satan Got Behind Me. And
yeah.
Midnight of the Century is the one I'm thinking
yeah.
of. Yeah. Episodes like that, which a lot of them are really high rated, in my opinion. Yeah, I can see the reason being there. I definitely would put it in my top third of episodes over the course of the season, definitely, for me. Right, okay. Do we want to go into the episode fully?
Let's get on a plane and go to Germany, Kurt. Let's do it.
Okay, so we open up with a scene from 998 AD.
As you do.
As you do. In a Millennium episode when it used to be Serial Killer of the Week. We open in 998 AD. And there's a lot going on here, isn't there? What did you think of the cold open here with the people on horseback, that the guy had the tattoo on his back, that you've got them quoting the Millennium phrase, that this is who we are in Italian, I think it is, or whatever it may be. For me, it feels like it's what the episode is. The cold open pretty much is the entire episode over the 45 minutes. What did you think of that cold open?
I agree. I think it's very much establishing that this is a mythology heavy episode. You know, this season two of Millennium very much takes a cue from the X-Files playbook of doing these kind of cold opens. You know, the X-Files would do this all the time. They'd do a cold open in a different time period or in the past, you know, and they would establish a point of mythology or a mystery or something that digs deeper into the, you know, the fabric of what was going on in that show, and then they would play it out in the modern day. And that's exactly what this does. This establishes that the Millennium Group has existed for 1,000 years. And this has been hinted at, I think, in previous episodes, you know, earlier in the season.
Yeah, Beware of the Dog had the tombstones, didn't they? Where, yes. On the rocks and stuff, so...
Yeah, exactly. So Beware of the Dog sort of tees up the idea that the Millennium Group has a mythology behind it and a structure, and it's more than just a consulting firm, which obviously it was in season one. And, you know, this show, we've gone into detail in the podcast before about how that changes and how that's, you know, something that was a change that Morgan and Wong brought in as opposed to Chris Carter. And this is them establishing what they see the Millennium Group as, which is this occultist... ancient organization which is involved in a battle that has gone on for thousands of years, you know. So immediately, yeah, you're pitched in the middle of something that, you know, 1,000 years before, in 998, these guys were trying to get the hand of Saint Sebastian to defeat the evils of that millennium, you know, of 1,000, you know, AD. So I think it's great. It's really evocative. It's nicely shot. Apparently it was pissing down with rain. You can't tell, but Thomas J. Wright said in the commentary, which is a really good commentary on the DVD, which I invite people to listen to. He says it was pouring down with rain, and they managed to make it look like that it wasn't. It was freezing cold, even though it would have been Italy, which would have been a bit less chilly than Canada, you know. But I really like it. I think it's like you say, it sets the store for what's going to come later.
You know, when you look at that episode and that opening, that one of the big things that they say within that cold open is that it's not the snakes in the open you need to worry about, it's the snakes in the grass. And they're saying that the church is opposed to them. How do you think that fits with the group as such? Because it's obviously, we're becoming aware that this is an entity. I know season three changes that a little bit, but it's very much an entity. Where do you think that they actually fit in with this whole situation then? Because it does feel like they're quite a well known group as well. They're not some group that are in the grass, as it says. They do definitely seem to be more open around this time period, really.
Well, I think it's a lot of it goes back to the fact that James Wong particularly wanted to recreate an essence of the Knights Templar. Mm. And he did a lot of research into the Knights Templar and into Freemasonry, which are, I mean, the lore behind that and the history and the depth is astonishing. You know, and this episode, if there was ever an episode that could have been written by Dan Brown, it's The Hand of Saint Sebastian. You know, he's very Angels and Demons Da Vinci Code-esque, that kind of codes and symbols and mythic secret history. And the idea of the Knights Templar, you know, they were a Catholic military order after this cold open, so it was more like the 12th century. But they were a really powerful, essentially secret society, organisation. And in literature and in myth and in culture, you know, all kinds of pop culture over the years, they've been, you know, in things ranging from Assassin's Creed, you know, through to the kind of Indiana Jones stuff. They are this secret society that have been involved in all kinds of stuff over the last 1,000 years. And I think the place of the group is they are an organization that sort of operate separate to the church, because that's the thing. They don't, and Owls and Roosters very much sort of sets this out, that you've got a side that's basically religious and you've got a side that's scientific.
Yeah, secular, you know, isn't it?
So. Yeah, secular and religious. And you've got these two arms of it. So the group, I think, is one of those things where it functions as an entity to sort of, like the Knights Templar were a militaristic order sort of aligned with the church, the group has power, resources, money, and has an agenda in that sense, whereas the snakes in, what was the phrase again? The snake in the open
and the snakes in the grass.
What's the one you've got to look out for?
You've got to look out for the snakes in the grass.
Right. The snakes in the grass are the well, I mean, I don't know about you, but to me, the bad guys in this are Odessa.
I don't know. We never get told, do we?
No. I think it's pretty likely that they are Odessa, which are the villains in the Nazi villains in owls and roosters. Because, I mean, it's in Germany. They're sort of German hitmen. Yes, I know we find out, you know, spoiler, Cheryl's involved. But I think, but then again, it could be one of the sides of the group, couldn't it? I mean, I suppose it is possible that it could be a splinter faction of the group itself, maybe.
Yeah, I think they were saying
they've gone bad.
You mentioned that the research that was taking place and they wanted to use those kind of ideas, but the big thing within those groups is that there was infighting. So
yeah,
it's opening up that window of potential to be anyone, really, doesn't it? Really, so
it's very interesting. Like you said, it isn't really ever massively spelled out conclusively. Who's who, what's what, where's where in the ancient history stuff, but you can infer enough to sort of get the idea of what's happened then is repeating, is cyclical. It's repeating 1,000 years later, essentially, with different players, but with the same long-standing battle going on.
So overall, Code Open, for me, as you say, it's a very X-Files-esque kind of opening. When we come out of that, we actually move forward in time to the Mummy in the Bog. That's the best way of describing it.
The worst sequel to The Mummy Returns ever.
And it's definitely not starring Brendan Fraser.
That'd be good.
So I actually think that scene's really well structured. I think this is one of the things with Thomas J. Wright, which we'll get into here, is that during the whole episode is... And you mentioned his commentary. You mentioned this in commentary about the use of widescreen in this episode, that, you know, Millennium Season 2 uses the widescreen format. And I had this conversation with Darren. I don't remember if it was broadcast in widescreen or not, but the use of it through this episode is particularly well done. I think the police scene when they are arrested, that there's some Dutch angles that are used quite well. There's the scene where we meet Cheryl for the first time, that's really low and looking up at Cheryl, and we've got them all planted into a three-way kind of thing, and some of the darkness that they use, and obviously the explosion, and some of the, as I say, some of the chase scenes are using Dutch angles and things. Thomas J. Wright as a director, it does a lot in Millennium. What did you think particularly to this episode? Do you think that it did give that otherworldly and wider feel to the episode to make it feel grander?
Oh yeah, definitely. And I believe he was a protege of Hitchcock himself, actually, Thomas J. Wright. I'm pretty sure when he was a young man. I'm sure I read that somewhere. I might be getting him confused with somebody else, but you can definitely see that, you know, in what he does. And this, you know, these are the episodes, I think, that really start to establish him as, if there is a comparable, you know, director to say who you had in the X-Files, I'd say Thomas J. Wright's probably the Rob Bowman of Millennium in many ways, in that he's the director, or potentially even the Kim Manners as well. He's the director that really sticks out as the person you go to when you really want to crank the direction up a notch. And, you know, that's why he comes back and he does Owls and Roosters, which are fantastically directed, Luminary, A Room with No View, The Time Is Now, with that incredible Laura Mean sequence. Yeah. You know, he does a lot in season 3, which obviously isn't as great a season, but a lot of the episodes he does are really interesting, and he becomes, you know, he directs the series finale, he directs Millennium, the X-Files last episode of Frank. So, you know, he becomes the key director for the show, and I think this kind of episode really establishes that he can move with the different genres, because that's the thing. Season 2 of Millennium basically covers almost every single genre you could imagine, you know, week by week. You know, every single week, one week it's a detective show, one week it's a comedy, one week it's an action adventure, one week it's a conspiracy theory. What, you know, it's one week it's the Zodiac Killer. You know, it's amazing. You know, the scope of this season is astonishing, and he can roll with that really well. And I think in this episode, he does, like you say, he uses a lot of these visual techniques to really throw you into this sort of dark, strange, esoteric espionage world. You know, this is, in many ways, it's a spy thriller as much as anything else. It really does play like an action-adventure espionage movie. you know, or at, mixed with a Hitchcockian thriller, mixed with a cop show, mixed with a little bit of Indiana Jones. And the fact he manages to bring all that together visually, I think, is a testament to him as a director, because the script is all over the place, you know? So it's really, he does it really well.
Yeah, yeah. Even the likes of the next scene, we've got two scenes back to back at the beginning. We're not going to go through this like scene by scene, but there's two scenes back to back here where you've got the low sunshine coming through the bog and the peat and through the actual tractor or whatever it's called, the JCB. And then you've got this juxtaposition of the Elder, who has appeared in, I think, one episode before this, but this is the first kind of glimpse that we get of him. I think there's an episode, isn't there, beforehand where he says something like, you know, help him, and they go and help him. But this is the first time that we get a full scene with the Elder. And obviously using the word Elder as well has X-Files connotations.
Yeah.
As well. But what did you think to, one, necessarily just him, but also the fact that this is very much more of a Peter-esque episode. I know that Frank kind of takes over towards the last 5 or 10 minutes, but it is very much a Peter episode, and we'll get into Peter shortly, but it's his reluctance to, well, his faith is now pushing him. I think we'll get into it now. His faith, and he's something that he really picks up on when he plays John Locke in Lost as well, that he's driven by this need to find out the truth of the matter. He's saying it's not necessarily about faith, it's about the science, but that doesn't really then track later in the episode, which is
bizarre. Yeah.
What did you think of that scene with the Elder and Peter having that conversation that, you know, you're in the group, you shouldn't be doing this, it's off book, you can't be following this path?
Well, I mean, I love it. I all this stuff I love, you know, and you get a lot of this stuff then crop up in Owls and Roosters, which is, like we say, the sequel to this, basically. Yeah. This is the prologue for that two-part episode. And the Elder then comes back, played by Philip Baker Hall, who's a great character actor. He's cropped up in so many really good things. In fact, it was just before this that he really broke out as a much older man. He was already in his 50s, really, 60s even, when he really started to break out. And it was Hard Eight, the Paul Thomas Anderson movie.
Yes.
And then Magnolia, which was a year after this. And then from then on, he started to crop up in all kinds of different things over the years. And he's a great character actor. And it's a very mysterious role, because ultimately he is... Because this episode really establishes there's a hierarchy in the Millennium Group, more than previously. Because obviously, we met the old man in Beware of the Dog. Yeah. And the old man, Owls and Roosters sort of brings it all together in that you really start to understand the hierarchy of where the old man sits and where the Elder sits and then where all the other group members sort of sit, including Peter. And where Frank sits in relation to that as well. So this sort of clarifies that there is a structure and that there is a guy, essentially. There's a guy sort of underneath the guy. The old man is, it's almost like, if you look at it, like the old man's the emeritus president and the Elder is like the prime minister running the show. You know what I mean? It's that kind of thing. The old man is in charge, but it's funny. I mean, you're a fan of Lost. Right. Yeah. If you look at it from that perspective, the Elder is Ben Linus and the old man is Jacob. He's the guy in the cabin and he's the one you only contact when you need to. He's the sort of spiritual mentor. He's the one that the initiates go to, which is what happened in Beware of the Dog, when they go through that trial process at the beginning. So I love that. I love that fact. And you really see through the Elder in this scene, which is really, really brilliantly written, because it's a lot of the dialogue is quite mythic and strange. You know, I love that phrase, if we found out, they already know.
Yeah.
You know, stuff like that, which is really, it's really abstract, but it really gets to the idea that there is this secret war going on underneath. And the Elder is one of these guys that, you know, you clearly don't mess with. In terms of Peter, one of the things I really love about season two is Peter Watts. He is... Dare I say it, and I might have said it in one of the other episodes I've been on before, but he is my favourite character in Millennium. Partly because Terry O'Quinn's my favourite actor, which I know I've mentioned before. but also that, much as Frank is obviously amazing, I love the story Peter goes through, even though where Peter ends up in the end is a shame, But season two, if you take all that away, season two has a brilliant story for Peter. Because, and we talked about this a bit in The Curse of Frank Black, Frank is very much on a classic mythological hero's journey. But then so, in a way, is Peter. Peter is on one that sort of mirrors Frank in that what he's trying to understand is quite... I feel it's like what the millennium means in itself. Whereas Frank is trying to understand his place in the Millennium Group to get back to Catherine and get back to the house and get back to Jordan and the family, whereas Peter is trying to understand the bigger picture. You know, he's trying to understand whether it is science or whether it is faith he has to believe in.
Yeah, I mean, you've only got to look back at the beginning and the end with the boy in the cooler.
Exactly.
That baby thing, that he's lost his faith and he's still holding up his end of the bargain, isn't he? So... That's his big monumental moment that brings him to where he is now. That he's still looking for the faith, for the science, really.
Absolutely. And this episode, I think, really shows that he's tipping more towards faith, because he's willing to risk a lot to get this relic. You know, the Millennium Group are saying, no, there are dangerous forces out there who are hunting this. We've got to be careful. And Peter then goes off on his own. He goes off book, essentially. Like, you know, like Joseph Haim later on talked about all the cop shows he loves and all these, you know, mavericks. Peter is that. Peter is that sort of maverick in this episode. And then he drags Frank along with him. And they're at this point, those two right now, where Frank trusts Peter enough to go with him and to go along with him, even though he doesn't really understand why he'll do it. Whereas by the time you get to Owls and Roosters, that trust completely breaks down. And as we'll explore later in those episodes, you see that fragmentation. But without the hand of Saint Sebastian, you wouldn't have been able to do that. You wouldn't have been able to have Owls and Roosters. And I think Peter's story here is crucial to what happens later in the season.
Yeah, I mean, if you go back to what Peter's done in season two, so we do get the, as you say, the cooler. Thing, which is where we get his kind of story to it. But then
it's brilliant, that is one of the best scenes I've ever seen.
But then this is where the when Frank gets asked, you know, it's not a professional, it's a personal issue, that we've only had hints, like in the beginning and the end, we do have that discussion, but we also have him say, Frank asking, why wasn't I told? You get in Sense and Antisense, you get the end scene, which alludes to where Frank and Peter are, that there's that stretch between them. Do you think that there hasn't really been a deep personal connection at this point? Would you have liked to have seen more of that before this episode, or do you think there's enough sprinkled in that is just enough to get through it?
No, I think it's enough, because throughout season one, Peter's he's much more of a functional sort of partner character to Frank. And over season one, he becomes the most interesting partner. You know, all those season one episodes, the most interesting episodes are the ones usually, unless he's with Bletch, it's the ones where he's with Peter. And especially if the three of them are involved, it's even better. And that's partly because of Terry O'Quinn and his dynamic with Lance Henriksen, which is fantastic. They work really well off each other. But you've got that trust established professionally between them before Frank starts to realise that Peter's essentially a bit of a zealot, you know, that he's essentially a cult. he's a cultist, you know. He is somebody who has devoted his life to this occult, ancient cause, in order because he believes, and you know, Midnight of the Century really spells this out in that brilliant scene in his house. He believes that the end is nigh, essentially, and that he's trying to understand it in order to help try and prevent it. So, season two then turns him much more into the mentor figure, the person guiding Frank into this world, pulling him in. And you see that in Beware the Dog, you see it in Monster. He's absent in like The Curse of Frank Black, because that's different. That's more about Frank's internal journey. But this is a really important episode that builds on what we have seen in those opening episodes, but like you say, the beginning and the end, which gets into his psychology. This builds on all of those things. So no, I think it's been nicely built up to. But I think you couldn't have done some of the later episodes without the hand of Saint Sebastian. It's a crucial linchpin to the whole season arc and to Peter's story, because it establishes how far he's willing to go to prove what he believes. It establishes that level of trust between them. But it also establishes that Peter can almost abuse that trust. a little bit, and that he drags Frank into something that Frank is completely... It's so far out of Frank's depth, basically. I mean, you know, if you think about it, you know, Frank ends up in Germany hunting a mummified hand of a saint, fighting shadowy bad guys who are out of something, almost feel like they should be at, you know, Hydra agents, you know?
Yeah.
And it's, yeah. And it, compare that to something like, I don't know, one of the early season one, compare that to the pilot, you know, where he's in Seattle and he's hunting a serial killer. It couldn't be further from Frank's world. And you know, and this is one of those episodes where you get no mention of Catherine, you get no mention of Jordan, or barely any mention of them. This is so separate from any of that, that he is, he completely, by the end of it, you get the feeling that Frank is a little bit like, I'm not really going to do that again, a little bit. And that's why when you get to Owls and Roosters, he doesn't. He says to Peter, no, this is enough. You're not telling me anything. You're not really explaining anything. I'm not going there with you again.
Well, we do get to Germany, actually, and there's a couple of scenes here while we're in Germany, which are quite good. That the one, we get the typical "they're following us" scene. What did you think to Vancouver covering for Germany in the first instance? And then supposedly,
it's not too bad.
It's okay. It does the job, doesn't it? But then we also get the you said you've listened to the commentary, but he mentions Thomas Wright mentions that Terry O'Quinn really struggled with saying "bog mummy," which I think is fantastic. Yeah. That and apparently, if you look closely to the when that scene where they are being followed, that Terry O'Quinn is struggling a little bit to keep it together. It doesn't. You wouldn't know if you haven't been told that, but you've got to look really at the micro expressions in Terry O'Quinn. You can just sense it's about half a sentence away from coming out to the front. And obviously, Lance Henriksen has said in the past that he's not an exposition machine, so he struggles. No. But Terry O'Quinn obviously comes to that. We meet Joseph Heim as well, and then also within this scene, I absolutely adore the fact, I don't know if it's in this scene or the one later, where Frank's talking to whoever the police woman in charge is, and they say, "How long is your visa?" It's like 6 months. Well, we could be here for 6 months.
They were planning a longer holiday than they got in the end.
Yeah, exactly. so that but it really opens up. This is where we're saying it really opens up the canvas that we are moving to Germany, though. But
yeah,
it opens up this canvas of and idea and. As I say, Peter's given us the exposition of why they're there. When we get into the office as well, we're meant to see the crime scene. What did you make of that whole aspect of once we've landed into Germany?
I like it. I think that the whole scene where they're getting followed by the shadow. I mean, they couldn't be more conspicuous, could they?
You know, they are in long trench coats. She's like shaven head. He's like just
he's got like a fedora on his head. Like they are comical, sort of obvious bad guys. And there's some really interesting camera work, I think, that Wright does, in that he almost there's a point where Frank and Peter sort of walk past the camera and the camera sort of lingers on them both.
Yeah.
So it's very clear that it's trying to establish that they're being followed. But I think I like it. I like the espionage aspect, the subterfuge aspect of it. It does feel like it does feel different, you know, even though, yes, okay, it is Canada, it isn't, you know, they haven't actually gone to Germany.
Yeah.
There is still a sense of broader scale to it. And I appreciate them getting in Gottfried John as Heim, because he is a German actor, you know, they could have just cast someone from Canada and had him affect a German accent, but they don't. They get an actual German guy, and it adds a little air of authenticity to it, because he's mainly known as General Urimov from GoldenEye. So to Western audiences, anyway, he was, I think, he died a few years ago, but I think he was quite a prolific actor in Germany. But yeah, he's known as a Bond villain ultimately. But that was just before this. But he's great in this. He brings that level of... I mean, this is one of the things about this episode that I appreciate, and it's a Morgan and Wong trope. Much as this is completely daft from start to finish, and everything in it is ridiculous, and Terry O'Quinn and Lance Henriksen are by definition very serious actors, and they are very, and they deliver a lot of this stuff, bless them, with a real serious game face. And they really make you... The reason they're both great actors is because they can take all this nonsense and they can make you really invest in it and believe it. But Morgan and Wong very clearly have moments of levity. And they importantly throw in there things that they know are ridiculous. The car bomb, for one, right? Which is brilliant because I loved that when I was young. I loved that whole moment where it's an explosion and the slow-mo of them, you know, Die Hard style, just being blown. It's brilliant. So there's that. And then you've got characters like Haim, who is obviously obsessed with American cop shows, and he talks. I mean, what does Frank say at one point? He says, "You have a very colourful vocabulary." And he goes, "Thank you." And then he starts reeling off. Thank you. And he's like reeling off, you know, Kojak, Hunter, Tony Scully, who? The Commish, which is a great joke. Because I think Morgan Wong used to write The Commish, which was set in Canada. But there's lots of fun with that, and they play with him. I mean, really, he's ridiculous, because you can tell Frank and Peter are like, oh, come on. Yeah. But it does that. It does that comedy. And then it also throws in Rodecker.
Yeah.
You know, and cuts to the brilliant Alan Zink as Rodecker, lip-syncing to Planet of the Apes, helping investigate. But it does that, and I think it's crucial that it does, because I think if you didn't, this would be so stupid and so daft that it would be hard to really, really make it work. Do you know what I mean?
Yeah, no. Well, one of the things I was going to say, actually, which I had noted down, was that it's very self-aware of itself.
Yeah, it feels that.
It feels like, you know, the episode is, and as you're saying about the actor who plays Joseph Haim, that he is like one of the funny guys, and the episode itself is written in a way that's kind of funny, but Frank and Peter are the straight guys and they're just going through it, but they're the ones that ground it. Same with what you're saying, it makes it feel like, when you watch it first time, oh, this is fantastic pulpy, and you go back and reanalyze it and go, hang on, this is bizarre. No, and it's like it doesn't. Okay, so we've got a German cop who loves American cop shows. We've got Frank at the very end. I know I'm going to jump to the end here, but Frank at the very end, where he's given us the Columbo type line of, you know, you've forgotten one thing. You gave me your number. Which I only realised on a couple of episodes ago.
Yeah.
Thinking, oh yeah, that's very cop referential. And I think it just really balances well, because you can take it either way, you can take it always, and it still is a great... That's why I gave it an 8, because it's still a fantastic episode, whichever way you want to take it.
Because it sort of knows how silly it is. It knows how propulsive it is and pulpy. You know, it doesn't have any pretensions, I think, of it. It wants you to take it seriously, but it equally understands that it's a bit of a ride, this one.
Yeah.
And that's why I think, wisely, they come back to a lot of this stuff and they build on it in Owls and Roosters, but they do take it more seriously, and it works in that context because it is a different shade of what's going on. It is much more about the greater mythological conflict going on. There's lots of different characters involved, and it's not as silly. But this one, it's fine that it is, because it establishes key points along the way. And I just think that having those moments of levity, having those that silliness, just it helps.
Yeah,
it helps bring you into it. And I think where the episode falls down, the points where it falls down, is when it's sort of... I mean, for me, the big problem in this is Cheryl Andrews, because you have to buy something with her that is completely out of nowhere and doesn't sort of, for me, track with everything else that's going on. And I think you've got to buy into that more than the episode deserves.
The way that I understand it, and correct me if I'm wrong, is that the whole concept of the episode is that the snakes in the open are the people who are actually following them. So let's call them Odessa for now. It's Odessa that's following them. But the actual snake in the grass is Cheryl.
Yeah.
So we're not meant to expect it, Cheryl. But the problem with that is, the last time we saw Cheryl was in a very quick scene in Force Majeure, looking at the women, the girls in Force Majeure who committed suicide, which is a very, very kind of, well, that was a Gonzo episode as well. But but in that actual scene, there's not much going on. I think she was in Weeds before that.
Yeah.
So there's not really anything to even, you know, oh, I mean, most people, even if they were watching it semi-regular, might have blinked and missed her. So that's what really, really brings it down for me. And I think that, obviously, CCH Pounder plays it brilliantly, of course, but I just don't feel that there was enough behind her to be able to really get that across.
No, I agree. And this is my problem with it, in that you're expected to buy a twist with a character who is somebody they've intentionally brought back from the early, like you say, the first time she's appeared in season two. I mean, if they'd have done it properly, they would have layered her into season two. They would have had her crop up and help them on things like Monster, or be there in 1919, or you know, stuff like Sense and Anti-Sense. They would have brought her in and had Frank working with her, you know, and reminded people.
Sense and Anti-Sense would have been a perfect one with the fact that it's based on science. So.
Well, exactly. You know, you could have put her into a lot of these episodes. You know, you could have. I'm not saying she would have fitted in the Laura Means sort of mold.
No.
Because Laura Means, when she crops up, is a very different character. But imagine if, like, it had been Laura Means, know, in this. And it wouldn't have worked, because Laura's on a very different trajectory. But it would have been a surprise. It would have been, wow, okay, what? Like, that. Whereas with Cheryl, it's more like, okay, who is she again? You know? And it's that kind of twist that feels really arbitrary. You know, it feels like... there is no... In the first season, there is absolutely no suggestion that this is going to happen. But then you could have said the same about Peter. You could have said the same about all of this in season one. So that's not quite fair to say. But equally, I think to yank her out of season one is in a completely different context, put her in this and have her end up being a turncoat, end up working, being a splinter faction or Odessa or whatever she is, and then not really explain it properly either, and have it be... I mean, they bring her back in that god-awful season three episode, Skull and Bones, which makes not a lick of sense. And when she's dead, you know, and they find her bones. I mean, that's terrible, you know. And they sort of weirdly try and come up with some link and tether. Yeah, it's terrible, you know. And you think to yourself, well, you know, I mean, it doesn't ruin the episode, but it feels really hackneyed and it feels really unearned. When I you might as well have just had any old person play that role. You didn't even need to have a twist in the end. It could have just been a villain. It could have been Haim. You know, you could have had Haim do it. You know, and you could have just put him in there.
Or the head of police.
You know, she probably would have been a better fit, actually. You know, because you would have gone, oh right, okay, yeah, she was it. But it wouldn't have mattered because the episode's not really about that.
Yeah.
But then I suppose on the flip side, the point is that, you know, you have had layered in the snake in the grass, the snakes in the open. You know, I suppose it's a point of trying to underscore that the enemy could be anywhere, could be anyone. And I get that. I suppose from that perspective, that's why they did it. But it doesn't work.
One thing I would ask, that do you think it does work, or do you is the actual MacGuffin of the episode, which is the Hand of Saint Sebastian, which is what the episode's called. Because we were talking about before about how self-referential it is, how self-aware it is, how it's a daft, crazy idea that, you know, that this hand is going to defeat the evils of the millennium. But and I'll speak about John. I don't know who I'm talking about now. I'll talk about Frank's visions in a second, but.
John Black. Were you going to say John Black? Because that's my dad's name.
Is it?
Genuinely, okay. That's my dad's name. Yeah, and because my granddad was called Frank. Frank
yes,
Black.
Yes, yes. So, I'm aware of your granddad. I wasn't aware of your dad.
So. Well, there you go. Isn't that weird?
Maybe it was the Hand of Saint Sebastian.
Could have been.
So my question is, do you think that in some ways that having a daft, bonzo, crazy episode like this with the hand helps with what happens in Owls and Roosters with a couple of MacGuffins in that episode as well?
Yeah, it is a MacGuffin. You're absolutely right. You know, it is that that icon, that item that is that they are. It's not about what it can do. It's about what it represents. You know, and much like the the cross of the crucifixion is in Owls and Roosters, which is the next sort of, if you're going for like holy relics, it's the next level up.
Just a little bit.
you know, it's the ultimate level up. But and that's the thing, you know, I mean, it always struck me as being much more of a sort of metaphorical sort of thing. And that's sort of what they say at the end, that it's not about, it's about inside, what it's inside, not which fits tracks exactly with the whole sort of thematic idea of the whole season, about it being an internal journey that Frank is on, that Peter is on. And the hand is just an externalization, really, of that journey. Yeah. You know, it is a totem for them to hold, for them to go after. That, you know, it isn't going to be a comic book story where you literally have a hand that will impart some psychic knowledge about, this is how you defeat Satan. You know, it's not. It's much more, you know, a grail for them to go after, which is, you know, it is that grail quest. It is that whole, you know, item, that mythological item for them to seek. So it sort of establishes that the Millennium Group are after these totems, these items, these powerful icons that they believe will give them strength, will give them, you know, and I dare say that a lot of them do believe that they possess actual power. You know, that's what the suggestion in Owls and Roosters is, that the cross of the crucifixion actually, you know, what is it in that? That it was if you had it with you, your army would...
If you were in one side of an army, you wouldn't be defeated.
Right, okay, and that's why Hitler was after it, and that's why the Nazis were after it, and all this kind of thing. And you know, whether or not that's true or not, who knows? You know, it is that mystical idea. But ultimately, we're not going to go down that precisely Indiana Jones route where, you know, Frank's never going to find an Ark of the Covenant and out come ghosts. You know, it's much more about the internal thing. So I think it works in that sense. I think it sort of...
I agree. I do think it works. I think My question's more on, I think it's setting it up ready for Owls and Roosters. It's giving you that.
Yeah,
and this is definitely something that in Millennium does as a whole. I mean, you've discussed this before on like the X-Cast and on this show as well, that, you know, we're in very episodic television territory in the late 90s, but Millennium season 2 does have this arc and does have these themes and thoughts and processes that really kind of transcend the episodes themselves, and you can see that line, see that hero's journey for Frank, and see the arc of Peter, and you know, and actually see the actual Millennium Group develop over the course of season 2. That this is almost like, okay, these are kind of the things that we're going to go down. When you see it next, you're going to accept it more, and it's not coming out of the blue.
Yeah.
I think that's kind of what I think they were going for anyway. Speaking of that, the fact that we mentioned this before with the circle representing the beginning and the end, which is what the Elder says at the beginning of the episode. And that was in, as we say, 998 AD. And the Hand of Saint Sebastian itself overcoming those 1,000 years. Some arguments I've seen in reviews online is that defeats the object of Millennium because it's all about the apocalypse. I don't personally agree with that, because I think that the idea, as you said, it's internalized. It's this idea of life repeating itself and the ouroboros eating its own tail, but also the fact that you can succeed in your quest, and that was their issue 1,000 years ago. We're approaching the next circle of life, effectively. Is that how you viewed it? Would you see it any differently?
No, I think that's true. I think it's one of those things that I think Chris Carter, Morgan and Wong, all of the people involved in these kind of shows return to a lot, which is the idea that things never really end. You know, that the circle will repeat forever and that there is no ending as such. And it's something that, you know, it's a recurring thing in a lot of mythological stories. You know, you're seeing it now, you know, as we record, it's mid to late November, and Watchmen, the TV series of Watchmen, is on. And Watchmen is very much a book that's all about the idea of repeating history, and, you know, the battle between ideologies never really ending and things like this. It's a recurring trope. You know, you get it in Lost. You know, it happens in Lost, which is the spiritual successor to these kind of shows, you know, in many ways.
Another one for me would be Battlestar Galactica. I don't know if you watch that, but that was exactly the same sort of thing as well.
Completely. 100%. Absolutely. Yeah. You see a lot of this stuff, and I think that, you know, thematically, the X-Files and Millennium are a lot closer to each other than people think or people give it credit for. And they hew closer together as the two shows grow older, and particularly in this season. And they are always all about what that inner journey is, as opposed to the external journey. And I think the whole idea of the Ouroboros, of the snake eating its tail, is indicative of this battle happened 1,000 years ago. It's happening now, and it will happen again. It will happen in another 1,000 years. And it just the parameters just change. The players change. The stage changes, you know? And that's I think, one of the key messages, really, in that it's what we do with the knowledge. It's how we approach these evils that explains how we get through them. There isn't going to be this magical savior that will come and help us. And that's one of the things, you know, Millennium is all about the presence of evil and all the different forms that evil takes, whether it is Odessa, whether it is the internal factions and these merciless killers, whether it is Legion, the demon, Lucy Butler, all these different things. It takes these different forms over the course of these three seasons. But it all comes back to the same idea that how do you overcome the monster? You know, how do you overcome the evil? It is with that inner strength. You know, and that's something that Frank has. That's why, you know, when you get to Antipas, you get that amazing scene at the end where he's facing down Lucy Butler in the hospital, and he says, and she's screaming at him, and he says, "I'm not afraid. You want us to be afraid, and I'm not." And that's their last ever scene together, and that's brilliant, because it's him standing up to that, and it's like, no, this is what you want. And that's something that tracks. Doesn't matter whether Millennium's playing in all these different genres, it always comes back to the same idea, I think. It's just in the hand of Saint Sebastian, it's a rip-roaring adventure, which is why it's so much fun.
There's not much more really to discuss with the episode in some ways, but a couple of things that I think would be quite interesting to go through is some of the logistical issues that we have with them, especially with the Doctor, and because the Doctor's in protective custody.
Yeah.
Obviously, they find out that he is in protective custody, and then Peter is framed. Peter is framed via the porn website, which magically comes on exactly when Frank and Peter are there. But that is good done by, obviously, Cheryl Andrews must know that Peter's just been sitting there all night, and you know, they log in, and that's it gone. So the Doctor being the person that draws Peter into it is an interesting one. But what did you think of likes of the turnaround where he says that it was Peter Vatt who killed me who attempted to kill me and things like that? What did you think of the Doctor and how that all played out?
He's funny because he's almost like that classic sort of European doctor, you know, eccentric, he's a silly German man who likes pornography kind of thing. You know, American shows do this a lot.
Yeah.
There are always these little, you know, I remember there was an episode of Alias where they have a mission and they go to Germany and there's this German like hacker or whatever, and he's a kinky so-and-so, and they truss him up in like kinky underwear and then blackmail him. And they say, "Oh, we'll send you these pictures to your wife," and all this kind of thing. So it's the same kind of thing, you know, in that they these kinky German, you know, middle-aged men. I think that's fine. You know, it allows them to play the comedy a bit. I think it's all this stuff is the part of the episode that's the least compelling.
Yeah.
All the little nutty sort of stuff with Dr. Schlossberg and all that. It's a bit like, oh, whatever. Yeah. It doesn't matter. None of this, none of it really matters in the end. You know, it's all just a means to get us to where we need to go. It's all about establishing who the good guys and who the bad guys are, really. You know, and that's why you get Cheryl coming in and barking at the German head of police that, you know,
This is an outrage.
Peter was an assistant director of the FBI, which makes me wonder if he ever knew Skinner.
Yeah, it does. Yeah,
like, that's always my thinking. Like, he must have known Skinner, surely, and Skinner must have gone, why is there a bloke who looks exactly like SAC Darius Michaud, who looks exactly like that guy in Aubrey? Yeah. Is there a bloke? Is he an alien? Has he been? I think Terry O'Quinn is an alien clone. This is my Uber theory. Peter Watts and all these guys, Darius Michaud, they're all clones. They're all alien clones. That's my. I'm going to put that out there now for you.
Okay.
Here you go.
So you think a clone or a replacement? Because it could be a replacement.
The guy in,
I know it's
the guy who trusts no one in is an alien replacement. Well, we're going far too X-Files here, aren't we? Sorry, everyone.
Yeah, we are.
But no, I think it's all the Dr. Schlossberg stuff is fine. It just gets you where you need to be, really.
Yeah, I think that was my point. I think it gives us, we briefly mentioned Rodecker, it gives Rodecker some interesting comical lines to express, doesn't it?
And man is evil, capable of nothing but destruction. I love that.
And so, and the scenes where he's like, saying, if you get my drift. it's your hand if you get my drift.
You bloody bastard. I love it when he does that.
And I think we do need to discuss the absolutely amazing scene. I love this scene. It's one of my favourite scenes, and it's just hilarious without meaning to be hilarious, is when Frank Black gets stuck in the bog. Because the way he reacts is absolutely amazing. It's just like, help.
Peter. Yeah. Like, if it had been like a modern day show, it'd have been like, shit!
He's just the calmest person. I mean, obviously, you're meant to be calm in those type of situations, but he is the calmest person I've ever seen sinking, ever.
You've got to remember, though, this is Frank Black, right? Not much can ruffle Frank.
No.
You know, this is a guy who's face down like Satan himself. Like, he can cope with a bit of bog,
I think. And then, obviously a means to an end as well, the fact that we do find the circle of the Chronicles, and that's how we find the hand, and we get the final scene, which you've mentioned about the inner thoughts. Is there anything else within the episode that you would like to bring up before we bring this section to a close?
I don't know. I don't necessarily think so. I think really it's just... we've covered a lot of the points, really. It's a very sort of pulpy, throwaway kind of episode in a way. Even though it's crucial to the season arc, it's very sort of silly and flimsy in a way. It's one of those episodes that you can just put on and you can just really enjoy.
Yeah.
You almost don't have to think about it that much. It just sort of breezes over you in a way. And I really love it for that. I love the propulsion of it. I love the fact it blends together all these different elements, all these different things that you can tell Morgan and Wong are just having a great fun putting it all together. And I think that kind of thing is... Yet at the same time, it still has the gravitas. It still has the Millennium feel. It still has the, you know, the sense that this is a bit epic, a bit mythological, a bit cosmic, yeah, and mythical, and all. I just love it. I think it really just brings all these elements together well. And even if it doesn't hang together, even if really, if you analyse all the plot beats and all the it's a bag of nonsense. It doesn't matter,
yeah,
right? It doesn't matter. It really does work, and it just shows just how well they could make this show something different every single week in this season. And I love it for that.
Yeah, I think we've got Doomsday Defense after this one, don't we? So that just goes to show just how different.
Look at that. That we can go. That's good. And then you've got Midnight of the Century, which is this beautiful, slow-moving, elegiac piece of drama about Frank's family and about his dad. And that couldn't be more different from the zany Doomsday Defense. And then you go to a creepy sort of season one-esque serial killer episode, you know?
Yeah,
Harold Shipman. You know, basically, it's great. It's great. It's a really, really brilliant season. You know, and it just these kind of episodes just show that.
And I think that's a perfect time for us to call it a night on this one. Let's move on to next week's Doomsday Defense. So before we go, though, we do need to find out what you're up to. And I know you've got quite a big moment happening in the next few weeks, and I'm sure this episode's going to be out very shortly anyway. So what have you got in the pipeline, Tony, and where can people find you online?
Yeah, actually, I have a book coming out, which is exciting, at the end of this month when you're listening to this, unless you're a patron and you've heard it a couple of weeks before. At the end of December, my book, Myth Building in Modern Media, is coming out, and there is quite a bit of Millennium content in there, because part of it, it's all about the myth arc, the you know, how mythology works in modern media, TV, films. And I say modern media, I'm talking about stuff that's from the 60s onwards. So, and Millennium, there's a big chunk about how Frank's journey within the Campbellian sort of hero's journey. So there is discussion, I think, of Hand of Saint Sebastian in that book. So I think you know, it's a shameless shill, but genuinely, if you're a Millennium fan, I think you'll really enjoy aspects of that book. And you can find it on Amazon. It's from published by McFarland. It's not cheap. It's 40 quid. I don't know how much that is in dollars. So, you know, it's a lot, even at Christmas, even a New Year gift, it's a lot to ask for. So, you know, if you really want to read it, I suggest you get your library to buy it, your local library. They'll do this. You just got to go in and say, can you buy this book? I want to read it. And they should. And then you can read it for free, basically. So, yeah, keep an eye out for that. And beyond that, then it's just... all the other We Made This content, really, on the We Made This podcast network that we're part of. So, you know, we've got the X-Cast, which is still airing, now into season 5. So as you're listening to this, we're just around episodes like Detour in season 5, the Postmod Prometheus, things like that. Kurt, you're on that. You're going to be on that show for an episode or two.
I am, yeah.
Coming up, which is exciting.
Yeah, I'm looking forward to some of them I haven't recorded yet. So I'm looking forward to doing a couple of episodes there. So that'd be great.
Yeah, that will be good. And so that's still going on. We've got plenty of other content. If you go to @WeMadeThisPod on Twitter and on Facebook, and we're going to have a proper web. We've sort of got a website, but it's sort of still in the throes of being put together and properly getting set up. So we're going to have that in 2020. As well, so you can find all that stuff. And if you want to find me, you can find me individually at my website ajblackwriter.com and on Twitter at ajblackwriter. So there, that's basically it. And I'm sorry, we haven't got a mailbag for this episode. I should have really put that call out, to be honest, because I think that's my fault. We should have had some fan feedback, but that's on me this time.
Well, never mind. It's all good. I'm sure people will. By all means, on the Yellow House on Facebook, once this comes out, to give us your thoughts and ideas, and we'll gladly have a look at them and read. It makes great conversation. It's we've got quite a few people in the Yellow House now, and there's conversation starting to pick up in there. So it's really good that people are doing
that.
It's great. You can also, as well, that I have asked for that book for Christmas. So I'm hoping on Christmas Day it's going to be there, so it should be good. I'm looking forward to it.
Whoever buys it for you, tell them I'm sorry.
I will.
No, both for the price and for the book. So, you know, it's...
And the time it'll take reading it. So it'll be like, are we going to the... Are we going round to your mother's today? No, I'm reading this book, sorry.
I read this book and it's long. It's really stodgy. But it's somebody I know. I've got to read it.
Exactly.
Actually, it's fairly thin, actually. So it shouldn't, in theory, take too long. He says, famous last words.
He says, with Kurt going round to his mum's house, opening the book and let them talk for hours. But it's all good. But you can find me on @RMuldrake on Twitter. So that's RMuldrake. You can obviously listen to episodes of The Time Is Now with myself and Tony. And all the information will be on in the credits for that. As Tony says, I'll be on the X-Cast a couple of times as well. I'm just starting to think about preparation for second season of Pick Up a Podcast, which is a podcast about podcasters and podcasting. So that's starting to get developed as we speak. I'm starting to make some, inquiries to people. So that's all good. Mm. Tony, I will get you at some point, but just not quite yet. Wait, I'm waiting.
That's fine.
I'm waiting for your fully fledged We Made This website and everything, and then we'll go for it.
I can be the series finale.
You could be.
I can be the goodbye to all that, basically. In the end.
You could. Yeah, but other than that, remember everyone, this is who we are.
The Time Is Now, a Millennium podcast, was created by Tony Black, who co-produces alongside Kurt North. You can find the show on Twitter at The Time Is Now Pod, and on Facebook if you type in The Time Is Now. Plus, we have a Facebook fan group called The Yellow House, full of active Millennium discussion. The Time Is Now is also part of the We Made This podcast network at We Made This Pod, alongside a range of popular culture shows about TV, film, music, and beyond, including our sister show, The X-Cast, an X-Files podcast. For advance access to The Time Is Now and access to bonus material, consider supporting the X-Cast and We Made This on Patreon at patreon.com/TheXcast. That's patreon.com/TheXcast. You'll find a full range of subscription tiers available. Thanks for listening.